Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit the Grove Museum in Tallahassee, originally the home of Territorial Governor Richard Keith Call.
It sees a transition from a time period where people are enslaved and being forced to do labor to when Governor Collins lives here, his efforts in the civil rights movement.
We'll reassess the relationship between Seminoles and people of African descent.
Africans engaged in the social and cultural traditions of the Seminoles and fought beside them in military alliances. Intermarriage played a prominent role in the integration of black men into the Seminole matrilineal society.
And we'll discuss the new Florida Civil Rights Museum. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Grove Museum in Tallahassee was built around 1840 as the home of plantation owner and Florida Territorial Governor Richard Keith Call. It's adjacent to the current Florida Governor's Mansion. Historian Larry E. Rivers is author of books including Slavery in Florida, Territorial Days to Emancipation. Rivers explains that before the Civil War ended in 1865, Florida was an agrarian-based society dependent upon the labor of enslaved people.
Well, antebellum life in Florida from, let's say, 1821 to the Civil War or 1865 consisted of the production of cotton. That was the main economy of scales for those involved in farming on their plantations and farms. And the people who did most of the work were enslaved laborers. When you think about the state of Florida in 1865, 45% of the inhabitants in 1865 were enslaved workers. So enslaved workers played a dynamic role in the growth of Florida. This area called Middle Florida, that was the area that stretched from the Apalachicola River on the west all the way to the Suwannee River on the east. This tract of land was the most fertile land for growing up staple crops. And staple crops are generally called cash crops. These are your revenue crops like cotton, tobacco, indigo, rice. And in Middle Florida, the staple crop of choice was cotton. And when you look at Middle Florida, the area I just described, in 1830, 90% of the cotton grown in then the territory of Florida was grown in Middle Florida. Middle Florida consisted of Gaston County, Leon County, Madison County, Hamilton County, and maybe a few other counties. But when you looked at the production, the county that produced more than these other counties was Leon County.
Richard Keith Call built his plantation and home in Leon County. Call served as the third territorial governor of Florida from 1836 to 1839 and the fifth territorial governor of Florida from 1841 to 1844. Call was a protege of Andrew Jackson. When Florida was named a state in 1845, Call ran for president of the United States, but lost to William Dunn Moseley. Even though Call owned slaves, he was loyal to the Union and argued against the secession of Florida in 1861. Trampas Alderman is executive director of the Grove Museum.
One of the important things about telling the story of the Grove Museum is also here at the Grove Museum is also telling the history and the story of the enslaved peoples that lived here on the property, that helped, that constructed the house behind me, that even made the bricks that you see in the house. The enslaved peoples that worked on the plantation, contributed to the wealth of Richard Keith Call. So it's important that we tell that story as well, that it does not get lost to history.
James M. Denham is professor of history and director of the Lawton Childs Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College. He's the author of several books about antebellum Florida.
Well, the Grove was Richard Keith Call's plantation, or at least his house. We don't really know exactly about how much acreage the Grove consisted of in terms of, well, what were there enslaved people growing things basically within the city limits. But Richard Keith Call's primary economic operation was, of course, on Lake Jackson, and he had thousands of acres out there. And we know that he lived in town. When he was in town, he lived in the Grove. But then, of course, primarily when he was out of politics, particularly, he spent almost all of his time out north of town in Lake Jackson. And the Grove itself is... It's very uncanny in that it's almost identical to the place that Richard Keith Call went often. In fact, he was married there, and that is the Hermitage, which was Andrew Jackson's plantation in Nashville. So he was, I think, kind of determined to create a kind of carbon copy of that here in Florida. And again, very early, one of the first substantial structures in the community, that is residences in the community. And of course, it's still there today, right next to the governor's mansion.
Leroy Collins, the 33rd governor of Florida, also lived in what is now the Grove Museum. In 1932, Collins married Mary Call Darby, great-granddaughter of Richard Keith Call. Collins served as governor of Florida from 1955 to 1961. Although he was politically moderate, Collins is remembered for advancing civil rights in Florida. Trampas Alderman, executive director of the Grove Museum.
So one of the unique things, one of the interesting things about the Grove Museum is it sees a transition from a time period where people are enslaved and being forced to do labor to when Governor Collins lives here, his efforts in the civil rights movement. And so you get the span of the history between those two different aspects.
The Grove Museum has three floors, including a basement.
So the basement of the house contains the offices of Leroy Collins, and that is where we discuss his political career. We also talk about his involvement in civil rights movement and the civil rights movement here in Tallahassee. And we also talk about the history of the enslaved peoples. As I mentioned, the house was built by enslaved peoples. The bricks were made by people that were enslaved. That's one of the key parts that we share when you come to visit the Grove.
The ground floor and second floor exhibits at the Grove Museum focus more on the Call Collins family. Trampas Alderman.
So the first floor and the second floor is dedicated to telling the family's history. There were some interesting members of the family, Richard Keith Call, his daughter, Ellen Call Long. And it was, so if you come, you get to experience the history of the family that lived here, the history of the area, as well as the history of the territorial period and modern Florida as well.
Historian James M. Denham.
One of the things that's happened during my lifetime is the full story of what went on in these places is being discussed, debated, and used, and particularly by using primary documents to recreate, for example, the daily life of what it was like to live there, and both for white people and black people, and for people that lived outside the so-called plantation world. poor white people, for example, and others who in some respects relied on the plantations because they were consumers of their labor and also their produce and so forth. So it's a very complicated story, and it can be a very hurtful story. But of course, it's one of the most interesting things about the Reconstruction period, for example, is how numerous African Americans became involved in politics, economic growth.
Most of the buildings associated with Florida's Antebellum Plantation Society no longer exist. A few, like the Grove and the Goodwood Plantation in Tallahassee, operate as museums. Historian Larry Rivers.
Well, I think there is a great value of preserving these plantations as historical sites so that you will know what happened during the antebellum period. And through your primary research, you can get the voices of enslaved people, the voices of those who own those plantations, and you can just see how society developed from a slave society to a society of freedom for enslaved people. They became free men and free women. So I think it's important that we not forget about the antebellum period, because the antebellum period sets up how blacks began to develop or continue to develop their institutions like their churches and their schools. All this started during the institution of slavery, but a lot of it was hidden. But after slavery ended, a lot of these institutions within the black community began to expand. So we need to know about the Grove. We need to know about Goodwood. We need to know about the Bannerman Plantation. We need to know about many of these plantations throughout Middle Florida, because they tell the history of a group of people who helped to make Florida what it is today.
The Grove Museum in Tallahassee is open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
More united we stand.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, one of the most persistent discussions in Florida history focuses on the frontier in the Spanish period and the status of Africans who lived in territory controlled by Seminoles.
Kevin Cocamore, a then PhD student at Florida State University, tackled that thorny issue in his 2009 article, A Reassessment of Seminoles, Africans, and Slavery on the Florida Frontier. He notes an extensive literature on Southeastern indigenous tribes and their relationship to enslaved Africans, with special focus on the topic of Maroons, the runaway enslaved people who established communities in the swamps of Florida, and compares these studies with those of historians in three other areas. Historians of Spanish Florida study the intersecting interests of Africans and Seminoles in military alliances that protected what was essentially a Spanish buffer zone in North Florida. Historians of slavery analyze the threat posed by escaping slaves, especially as they joined with Seminoles. Historians of the Seminoles argue that the First and Second Seminole Wars were a direct result of this alliance. The most contested efforts, Cocamore notes, quote, are those that have attempted to illustrate to what lengths Africans claimed as slaves actually represented bondsmen in Seminole country, end quote. Although the rigorous scholarship has produced, quote, an increasingly clearer understanding of the dynamic and hazy relationship, he argues most studies have come from specialists of the African-American experience or of slavery generally. Their evaluations of blacks in the territory stress maroon identities, cultural autonomy, and an African tradition, end quote. Kokomor argues that a clearer understanding will emerge by evaluating the role of Africans through the lens of Seminole history and culture. To understand the role of Africans, he re-examines agriculture and tribute using a native model, studies bondage, captivity, clan, and community within the context of indigenous traditions, looks at cultural, societal, and physical similarities in religion, dress, and intermarriage, and analyzes political and military alliances. Examining the relationship between Africans and Seminoles through the lens of indigenous history and culture, rather than European traditions, to understand the role of Africans in Spanish Florida, Kokomor argues produces a clearer picture of the role of bondage and maroonage.
Connie, a number of well-known 19th century observers, including Seminole War author John Sprague, abolitionist Joshua Giddings, and Seminole Indian agent Wiley Thompson, wrote insightfully on their observations of the African-Seminole relationship.
They did, and Kokomor cites their writings to make the point that observers of the period recognized a unique relationship in a time when chattel slavery dominated the black-white dynamic. For example, Joshua Giddings observed that Seminoles, quote, held their slaves in a state between servitude and freedom, the slave usually living with his own family and occupying his time as he pleased, end quote. This and similar observations complicate any analysis of traditions such as tribute. Viewing tribute by Africans as evidence of bondage that produced gain for tribal leaders removes the action from indigenous tradition and places it within the context of white plantation society. But as Kokomor argues, quote, from a native perspective, these offerings mirror the communal tribute systems normally expected of all Indians in Creek and Seminole tribes. Indeed, they illustrate agricultural traditions present in the Southeast for generations, end quote. Similarly, slavery must be examined through indigenous traditions of captivity as well as purchase. Captivity replaced lost tribal members or added to the tribal population to ensure continued viability. But Kokomor acknowledges that, quote, Africans being sold or traded to prominent Seminoles has been fairly well documented, and although infrequent, must be examined, end quote. The purpose for acquiring slaves is made cloudier because Seminoles did not engage in the plantation economy. He suggests that the slaves acquired by Seminoles were key to their survival as the tribes moved into new territories with new agricultural regimes. The lack of evidence of a pattern of sales of enslaved Africans by Seminoles reinforces their importance in adaptation to new circumstances and in the significance of the relationships between Seminoles and Africans. Africans engaged in the social and cultural traditions of the Seminoles and fought beside them in military alliances. Intermarriage played a prominent role in the integration of black men into the Seminole matrilineal society. Children of the Union would have been viewed as Indian, quote, whether a portion of that blood was black or white, end quote. As historians study religious observances of Africans and Seminoles, sources place Africans as participants in the Green Corn Dance, the largest of the celebrations in Seminole society. Likewise, Christian missionaries recognized the role of Africans in influencing Seminoles. One missionary remarked, quote, I am in hopes that if the blacks who understand English will hear me, end quote, they would influence the Seminoles to convert to Christianity. Africans frequently spoke English and or Spanish and acted as interpreters, thus playing a significant role in tribal politics. Finally, Africans and Seminoles had a history of military alliances stretching back to the 18th century. Taken together, Kokomor sees less evidence for numerous maroon communities and argues that, quote,
Far from proving culturally and physically autonomous black populations, a close examination of their habits and appearances points to daily interaction, which inevitably led to significant acculturation, end quote. He concludes, quote, "We do not see Maroons, we see black Seminoles," end quote.
Interesting as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Florida Civil Rights Museum is a virtual space that you can visit from anywhere. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Delatri Jordan Hollinger is the founder and co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum. He's also the founder and president of the National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. He's a fifth-generation Leon County resident. Jacqueline Yvonne Perkins is the co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum and the Robert and Turdy Perkins Foundation. I spoke with Delatri and Jacqueline about the Florida Civil Rights Museum, the nation's first born digital, entirely virtual civil rights museum. The museum was officially incorporated in 2021, but its conception emerged circa 2013 as a countermeasure to the many historic African-American landmarks being demolished or gentrified in Leon County precisely, and in Florida more broadly.
One of the buildings that was on the chopping block at that time was the Firestone Building, which was also the historic Leon County Jail Building, which is where many of the most significant events took place during the Civil Rights Movement. And so I suggested to city, state, and national leaders at that time that Florida, particularly the capital city of Tallahassee, should have a statewide focused civil rights museum. One of the individuals who agreed with that was then United States Senator Bill Nelson. I also had many conversations at that time with members of Congress and members of the state cabinet. The Secretary of State at that time, Ken Detzner, actually sent a letter in addition to Senator Nelson encouraging that building's preservation. And so when the building was demolished in 2018, what did come out of that was the Civil Rights Memorial Plaza, but also the idea that there should be a statewide focused civil rights museum in Florida. And so in 2021, the Florida Civil Rights Museum was officially, formally incorporated with Ms. Jacqueline Perkins and myself as co-executive directors. Ms. Perkins took the mantle and really she developed the budget for an initial civil rights museum. She advocated for initial funding to be granted to the museum.
The lack of knowledge regarding the civil rights era in Florida further provided the impetus to create the museum.
In Tallahassee particularly, people seem to, when they talk about the civil rights movement or even at the height of the civil rights movement in Tallahassee, the only thing they talked about was a bus boycott. And we wanted them to know there's so much more. So many other people whose names have never been called. And so we wanted to make sure that we told other stories. And there are many, many more to tell. It's not about a bus boycott. That was an integral part of this process of advancing civil rights, just like voting rights. But we wanted people to understand that civil rights is not defined as a bus boycott.
The scarcity of funds partly explains why the Florida Civil Rights Museum was a born digital project and why it continues to be an exclusively virtual space. Nevertheless, Delatri and Jacqueline have maximized the advantages of a digital medium in that users can learn about history in ways not entirely possible in a traditional museum setting.
The exhibits are created with the purpose of providing a holistic view of the person. So it's not a traditional museum, of course, but in the sense that you get more than just a paragraph on a placard. You get the opportunity to view several photographs of the individual, in some cases their newspaper articles, in other cases with our personal perspective series that Ms. Perkins created, you get an opportunity to view a video of an individual family member speaking about them and their most significant accomplishments.
And I'll give an example, and I know it's not a problem to do this. Justice Joseph Hatchett's grandson actually put together a wonderful presentation on his grandfather before he passed. He interviewed him. He had photographs. He had videos. And he talked about him about every aspect of his life. And there's so many interesting things, not only just about his grandfather being a Supreme Court justice, but also the election that led up to that. And this was a black man who was running against one of the most quote-unquote powerful and well-known individuals from a family in the state of Florida who founded Duval County. And Governor Askew asked another prominent individual in the state of Florida to serve as his campaign manager. And the campaign manager was saying, oh, he can't possibly win. But he won. And no one has won since then. So we're going to tell those stories and give people that additional perspective and have people talking about it rather than you reading about it. You'll hear that person. You'll see them moving. You'll see their reaction.
So it's multifaceted what you get with each and every single individual. You're able to really learn about this person in depth, and you can do it from anywhere in the world. It's certainly convenient, and it gives you an opportunity to learn a lot of information. For instance, the National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C., it might take you about 3 hours or more to walk through that museum. You can go through our museum on your computer screen at your leisure. You don't have to spend money on travel. You don't have to purchase a hotel room. So it has its advantages.
And I agree wholeheartedly with Delatry with that assessment. The advantage is that it's more attractive to young people. I know that the school systems can save money. They don't have to transport the students. The young people are used to being able to take their devices and navigate and kind of say, okay, I see that, I've read that.
Future plans to expand the museum and its influence include extending the focus from the Tallahassee/Leon County area to the entire state, creating new exhibits that feature historic landmarks and buildings during the civil rights era in Florida, and eventually having a physical location.
The Leon County Board of Commissioners initially provided a donation to the museum, and so that's why we're focused on Leon County at the moment. However, certainly we will be living up to our name of the Florida Civil Rights Museum and implementing exhibits throughout the year and in the years to come focused on other areas of the state. Our exhibits will go beyond individuals and will start to feature different historical landmarks. And so we'll tell the story of different landmarks around the state. For instance, Ms. Perkins and I are both advocating right now and have been to preserve the historic Robinson's Grocery Store building in the Bond community here in Tallahassee. That is an example of a building that we'll be featuring on our site in addition to many others. So we'll be expanding the platform to not only include individuals, but landmarks of significance. And also my hope is that in the coming years, we will expand to an actual physical location.
Miss Jacqueline Perkins.
It feels comfortable. It feels like you're in a museum. It feels like you're walking through. You see these beautiful photographs that have almost looked, this 3D experience, and you see the furniture and you're able to click on and then read the bios. I think that people will be very happy to see that.
To support the Florida Civil Rights Museum, a 501c nonprofit organization, please visit the virtual museum at www.floridacivilrightsmuseum.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Visit us anytime on Facebook and at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.